Honorable Vice Chancellor Professor S. M. Sajid, distinguished speaker of the day, Ms. Arundhati Roy, distinguished colleagues, guests and students, on behalf of the Nelson Mandela Center for Peace and Conflict Resolution, I welcome you all to the 6th Walter Sisulu Memorial Lecture organized by the Nelson Mandela Center for Peace and Conflict Resolution. The center was set up in 2004 and was one of the first of its kind in an Indian university. Professor S. M. Sajid, the present Vice Chancellor, was the first director of the Nelson Mandela Center, and he has to his credit the founding of the center, because it was under his supervision that the center was created. From the beginning, the chief focus of the center has been comparative and contemporary studies, and it aims to address a lack of serious and purposeful analysis of types and sources of conflict in our country, neighborhood, and the methods of dealing with them that India has adopted. The prominent objectives of the center are to research and document Indian approaches to the promotion of peace at home and abroad, to develop a curriculum of peace and conflict studies based on national, regional and global experience, to build capacity for conflict prevention and resolution in government and civil society agencies, and to promote a community of academic expertise in conflict prevention, management and post-conflict peace building. The center has trained students from different parts of India, especially the conflict regions of the Northeast and Kashmir. The center has also had students from the neighboring countries of Nepal, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Thailand and Afghanistan. Under the student exchange program, students have also come from France. One of the important components of the center's MA program is a week-long fieldwork trip to the conflict areas. Over the years, the center has focused on research, curriculum development and teaching, organized seminars and conferences, held short training programs for faculty, administration and civil society, hosted visiting fellows, organized interactions with eminent leaders in peacemaking, and partnered with other universities and institutions working in the field of peace and conflict studies. The Walter Sisulu Memorial Lectures were instituted in 2007 as a tribute to the memory of Walter Sisulu. Walter Max Oliato Sisulu, born in 1912, was a South African anti-apartheid activist, a member of the African National Congress, and considered to be a mentor of Nelson Mandela in his youth. Born to a domestic worker, Sisulu was raised in the tribal tradition by his mother's family and underwent Xhosa initiation rites. He received his primary education at a village school and at a nearby Anglican mission. In 1926, at the age of 14, he left mission school to take up a wide range of manual jobs. Sisulu joined the African National Congress in 1940 and, together with Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo, was instrumental in founding the African National Congress Youth League, of which he was initially the treasurer. He helped organize the armed wing of the ANC, Umkhonto V. Sizwe, Spear of the Nation, and set up its regional commands as the political commissioner. He was made Secretary General of the ANCYL in 1949 and held that post until 1954. For being a planner of the Defiance Campaign in 1952, Sisulu was arrested and given a suspended sentence. He told the court before he was sentenced, "I wish to make this solemn vow, and in full appreciation of the consequences it entails, as long as I enjoy the confidence of my people, and as long as there is a spark of life and energy in me, I shall fight with courage and determination for the abolition of discriminatory laws and for the freedom of all South Africans, irrespective of color or creed." In 1953, Sisulu traveled to Europe to attend the World Festival of Youth and Students in Bucharest, the USSR and China as an ANC representative. He published a book on African nationalism commissioned by the Government of India in 1954. In the 1950s and early 60s, he contributed numerous articles for the New Age, Guardian and Liberation. Between 1954 and 64, Sisulu was jailed several times. At the treason trial between 1956 and 61, he was eventually sentenced to 6 years, however, was released on bail pending his appeal. He went underground in 1963 but was caught at Rivonia on July 11. At the conclusion of the Rivonia trial, 1963-64, Sisulu was sentenced to life imprisonment. With other senior ANC figures, he served majority of his sentence on Robben Island, where he completed a BA in Art History and Anthropology and read more than 100 biographies. Sisulu was released from prison in 1989 after having spent 26 years in incarceration. In July 1991, he was elected ANC Deputy President at the ANC's first national conference after its unbanning. He remained in the position until after South Africa's first democratic election in 1994. He campaigned in the first truly multiracial elections in South Africa and saw his dream of black majority rule fulfilled. Sisulu retired after the election, though he kept an office at ANC headquarters where he would drop in from time to time. He became a patron of the UDF, the Omle Trust and the Twa Twa Trust and an honorary chancellor of the University of Bender. He held four honorary doctorate degrees. In 1992, Walter Sisulu was awarded Ishtwalanwe Siparanko, the highest honor granted by the ANC for his contribution to the liberation struggle in South Africa. As inspiring as his own life is the steadfastness and sacrifice of his family in the freedom struggle. Sisulu's wife, Albertina, was a nurse. At the wedding, the chairman of the Youth League, the late Anton Lembede, warned the bride, "You are marrying a man who is already married to the nation." As Walter dedicated his life to the liberation struggle, it was Albertina who supported the family. The couple had five natural children and adopted four more. Sisulu's wife and children were also active in the struggle against apartheid. Sisulu died on the evening of 5th of May 2003 at his home in Soweto after a long illness. His state funeral was held on 17th of May 2003. Delivering his eulogy at the funeral, Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, "I want to declare loud and clear that after a life so exemplary, so inspiring, we are filled with deep thankfulness. We have come to celebrate a wonderful life poured out so unselfishly on behalf of others." After this introduction to the memory of Walter Sisulu, I would like to remind the audience here that today is the sixth Walter Sisulu Memorial Lecture. We've had five lectures before this that were delivered by Professor Jairus Banerjee, Ms. Medha Patkar, Professor Richard Falk, Ms. Asma Jahangir, and Mr. Ahmed Kathrada. Today we have the noted writer and political commentator, Ms. Arundhati Roy, who has kindly accepted to deliver the sixth Walter Sisulu Memorial Lecture. Before I invite the distinguished speaker, I would now request the Vice Chancellor to give his honorary remarks.
Ms. Arundhati Roy, Professor Tasneem, my dear colleagues and respected guests and dear students. I offer my apologies to all of you for not providing you the adequate space and sitting arrangements. I think the organizers perhaps underestimated the charm and the charisma of the speaker. As also, I think the reason is that not many activities are going on presently in the university, so all the other venues have been booked. I would not say anything because I don't want to delay the lecture we all are here to listen to. I'll only say that the very theme of the topic is very, very relevant to the present context, as also to Jamia Millia Islamia, which was established under the patronage of none other than Mahatma Gandhi, and the constitution, which was largely authored by Dr. Ambedkar, and the spirit of that constitution, which is in secularism and pluralism, is very much cherished by each and everyone who is associated with Jamia Millia Islamia. Arundhati Roy, please.
Best of Good morning, all of you, and it's lovely to see such a crowd. Though, let me tell you that I'm a little bit nervous, because what I have to say, I think, is going to be very, very unsettling to almost everybody here. It's the other reason I'm nervous is because I've just written a very long introduction, a sort of book-length introduction to The Annihilation of Caste, which is one of Ambedkar's most famous texts, a famous text which in our apartheid society, only one section of society has heard about and the other has completely ignored. So while we do celebrate the end of apartheid in South Africa, I'm here to remind us that we live in a society which practices a most vicious form of apartheid, which is getting more and more complicated and less obvious, but deeper in many ways. What I'm going to talk about is a small part of what this entire book and my introduction to it deals with, but that part is going to be about Mahatma Gandhi's 20 years in South Africa. But I'll just briefly introduce how I began to think about this and how it came to be in a book about a book written by Ambedkar. The Annihilation of Caste was a speech. It's the text of a speech that was never delivered. So in 1936, a sort of Hindu reformist organization called the Jat Path Todak Mandal, which means the Forum for the Breakup of Caste, had invited Ambedkar to deliver its presidential address. And then they asked for the text of that speech in advance. And when they read the text, they were horrified, because they realized that Ambedkar was going to denounce Hinduism and to say, and just a few months ago he had said that though I had the misfortune of being born a Hindu, I will not die as one. And then it went on to denounce from the point of view of an untouchable, which is the word that he used to use for the depressed classes, which we call Dalits today. He denounced the sacred texts, and he said that he would renounce Hinduism. So the Jat Path Todak Mandal basically withdrew its invitation to him. And he went back, and at his own expense, he published 1,500 copies of this text. And the person who responded to him was none other than Mahatma Gandhi. And in his response, unlike the bigots of today, though Gandhi disagreed very vehemently with Ambedkar's text, he said every Hindu must read this text if only to disagree with it. So that was a sort of written debate between these two men, but it was just a moment in a very long debate and a very bitter conflict between Ambedkar and Gandhi. And even their conflict was not just theirs, because Ambedkar was the inheritor of a mantle of the anti-caste tradition that began from the time of the Buddhists, when they broke with caste, and went on through Kabir and through Jyotiba Phule, and I mean, I don't want to get into those details right now, but he came from one tradition and Gandhi came from the other, which is of the sort of privileged caste reform tradition, you know, of the Arya Samaj and the Ramakrishna Mission and so on. I'll just say one more thing about what was going on at the time. You see, at the turn of the century, what had happened was the whole idea of empire was changing into the idea of the nation. So no longer was it possible to ride a horse with an army into Delhi and take the throne. The whole conversation about the meaning of governance had changed. And now we were talking about representation and so on. And in that conversation, what happened was suddenly, not only were the many myriad communities of this subcontinent beginning to ask the questions about who had the right to represent who, the British were playing into this, mischievously playing into it, saying, you know, how, who has the right to represent the Sikhs and the Muslims and the untouchables, and how does a privileged caste party like the Congress, predominated by Hindu Brahmins, have the right to represent? And so there was a whole lot of mischief going on, and suddenly this very diverse nation was being synthesized, I mean this diverse subcontinent was being synthesized into a empire and people, into a nation, and people were going to have to call themselves citizens. So into this mix, sometime in 1915, came Gandhi, who returned from South Africa. I mean, he left South Africa just a year after Walter Sisulu was born. In 1913 he left. And he came back to India around 1915. And if the British had used their imperial mandate to sort of raise them above the fray and make them ask these very lofty questions while they were looting the subcontinent, causing famines and all of that, Gandhi raised himself above the fray by being a Mahatma. His Mahatmahood in some ways raised him above the fray. So when I actually started to read this debate between Gandhi and Ambedkar, it took me back into just looking at Gandhi through the prism of caste, because you know, it did strike me as surprising that Gandhi, who was a Baniya, who was the son of the Prime Minister of Porbandar, had to go all the way to South Africa to get thrown off a train to realize that there was injustice in the world. Whereas Ambedkar, who was born a Mahar and an untouchable, you know, from the time he was born, was treated so badly. When he went to school, he was only allowed to go to school because of British legislation allowing untouchables to go to school. Even today we know what happens to Dalit children in schools. He had to sit on a piece of gunny sack in the corner. He was not allowed to touch the water glasses. He was not allowed to drink. He had to sit on this gunny piece of gunny sack so as not to pollute the floor of the classroom. And from there, he, you know, his family moved to Bombay, and then the Maharaja of Baroda gave him a scholarship, and he went to study in Colombia. When he came back to India, he was given a job, but the carpets used to be rolled so that he wouldn't pollute the carpet that he walked on. The clerks would throw files at him so they didn't have to touch him. So, you know, he didn't have to travel very far to find injustice. In fact, when he went to Colombia, he had the first time an experience of being treated as a normal human being. So these are the two men that we are dealing with. When I started reading Gandhi on caste, Gandhi was a supporter of the caste system. Even till he died, he never effectively stood up and renounced caste. He supported it. He supported the idea of every caste doing the job that it had been divinely sort of ordained to do. He said Bhangis should always be Bhangis, Brahmins should always be Brahmins, but they should be treated equally, which was a bit of sophistry, really. So then I started to wonder, how did this man get to be called a Mahatma? Who made him a Mahatma? When was he called a Mahatma first? And I found that he was publicly called a Mahatma in 1915, which was very soon after he returned from South Africa. So clearly it was these 20 years of political activity in South Africa that made him a Mahatma. So since this is the Walter Sisulu lecture, I'm only going to speak about these years that he was in South Africa. I think that his views on caste were presaged by his views on race. And so I started to read, what did he say, what did he do in South Africa that made him a Mahatma? And did he fight racism and imperialism in South Africa? Was he really a friend of the Africans? and so on. So it's even this part is a bit long, but I'll try and just read to you what I can. For more than 35 years before, I'm talking about something else, Gandhi's Mahatmahood had billowed like a sail in the winds of the national movement. He captured the world's imagination and he roused hundreds of thousands of people into direct political action. He was the cynosure of all eyes and the voice of the nation. In 1931, at the second roundtable conference in London, Gandhi claimed with complete equanimity that he represented all of India. And in his first public confrontation with Ambedkar, over Ambedkar's proposal for a separate electorate for untouchables, Gandhi said, "I claim myself in my own person to represent the vast mass of untouchables." How could a privileged caste Baniya claim that he in his own person represented 45 million Indian untouchables, unless he believed he actually was a Mahatma? Mahatmahood provided Gandhi with an amplitude that was not available to ordinary mortals. It allowed him to use his inner voice. This is a very a thing Gandhi talks about very often, that he had his inner voice which would tell him what to do. It allowed him to use his inner voice affectively, effectively, and often. It allowed him the bandwidth to make daily broadcasts on the state of his hygiene, his diet, his bowel movements, his enemas, and sex life, and to draw the public into a net of prurient intimacy that he could then use and manipulate when he embarked on his fasts. And he said, "My aim is not to be consistent with my previous statements on a given question, but to be consistent with the truth as it may present itself to me in a given moment. The result has been that I have grown from truth to truth." Ordinary politicians oscillate from political expediency to political expediency. A Mahatma can grow from truth to truth. How did Gandhi come to be called a Mahatma? Did he begin with the compassion and egalitarian instincts of a saint? Did they come to him along the way? The first time he was publicly called Mahatma was in 1915, soon after he returned from South Africa to begin work in India, at a meeting in Gondal, in a town close to his hometown, Porbandar. At the time, few in India knew more than some very sketchy and rather inaccurate accounts of the struggles he had been engaged in, and these need to be examined in some detail, because whether or not they made him a Mahatma, they certainly shaped and defined his views on caste, race, and imperialism. So now let me just say this, that when I speak about him, I'm not interpreting anything. I am going to present you with the things he actually said and he actually wrote. Because this is some pretty disturbing stuff. Gandhi was 24 years old and trained as a lawyer in London when he arrived in South Africa in 1893. So he had a job as a legal consultant to a wealthy Gujarati Muslim businessman. Imperial Britain was tightening its grip on the African continent, and Gandhi, all of us know the story, right? All of us have been told the story of what was Gandhi's first political awakening. We know it. He was thrown out of a whites-only train compartment in Pietermaritzburg, right? So from that, we surmise that Gandhi was against racism, was against imperialism, and he began this battle. Well, this is only half the story. The reason Gandhi was outraged and the reason he was sitting in a whites-only compartment was he believed that it was below the dignity of privileged caste Indians to be, sitting with black people. So I'll read out what happens next. In 1894, Gandhi founded the Natal Indian Congress. The membership fee was £3. This at the time was a princely sum and meant that the NIC would remain an elite club. For a sense of proportion, 12 years later, in 1906, the Zulus would rise in rebellion against the British for imposing a £1 poll tax on them. So a £1 poll tax causes an uprising and a war, but the membership for the NIC was £3. One of the earliest... Oops. Wow. Okay. So anyway, I guess you can hear me. So one of the earliest political victories of the Natal Indian Congress came in 1895 with what was known as a solution to the Durban Post Office problem. And the problem was that the Durban Post Office had only two entrances, one for whites and one for blacks. So the Congress fought for a third entrance to be opened so that Indians would not have to use the same entrance as the blacks. And in a letter, in an open letter, Gandhi writes to the Natal Legislative Assembly, dated 19 December 1894, he says that both Indians and English spring from, I'm quoting, spring from common stock called the Indo-Aryan. And he cites Max Müller, Arthur Schopenhauer, and William Jones to buttress his argument. And he says, quote, the Indian is being dragged down to the position of the raw kafir. As a spokesperson for the Indian community, Gandhi was always careful to distinguish and distance passenger Indians. See, passenger Indians were the Indian businessmen who arrived in Africa, South Africa, to do business, whereas the indentured labor were the ones who had been brought in as bonded labor because the Zulus refused to work on the white man's farm. So Gandhi, here's Gandhi on the difference between the privileged caste Indians and the indentured labor, who are mostly Dalits and subordinated castes. And he says, Gandhi says, whether they are Hindus or Mohammedans, they are absolutely without any moral or religious instruction worthy of the name. They have not learned enough to educate themselves without any outside help. Placed thus, they are apt to yield to the slightest temptation to tell a lie. After some time, lying with them becomes a habit and a disease. They would lie without any reason, without any prospect of bettering themselves materially, indeed, without knowing what they are doing. They reach a stage in life when their moral faculties have completely collapsed owing to neglect. The Indian indentured labor whose moral faculties were in such a state of collapse were largely from the subordinate castes, and they lived and worked in conditions of virtual slavery, incarcerated on sugar farms. They were flogged, starved, imprisoned, often sexually abused, and they died in great numbers. But Gandhi soon becomes the spokesman. So while this racism and segregation is hardening in India, Gandhi's trying his best to signal to the British, who are tightening their grip, that look, we are different from these working class people. We actually, the words he used, we want an imperial brotherhood. He actually says this, we are looking forward to an imperial brotherhood. Now the racists are in a way not interested in all these distinctions between black people. For them, everyone's a coolie. And Gandhi is getting more and more annoyed at these upper sort of privileged castes being called a coolie. And he actually basically keeps on saying, like, for example, here's another quote where he says, like, for example, he goes to India in 1896 and he speaks at these sort of meetings where he's there's a huge amount of indignation at how business people in India are being treated by the whites in South Africa. So when he gets back to South Africa, there's a protest against him by many white people, and his boat is not allowed to dock. Finally, after 5 days, he gets off. He gets beaten up, and he's very brave, and he takes this beating with great fortitude. But the next day in an interview, he says to the Natal Advertiser, I have said most emphatically in the pamphlets and elsewhere that the treatment of indentured Indians is no worse or better in Natal than they receive in any other part of the world. I have never endeavored to show that indentured Indians have been receiving cruel treatment. So the problem is only about how the business people are being treated. In 1899, the British went to war with Dutch settlers over the spoils of South Africa. Diamonds had been discovered in Kimberley in 1870 and gold on the Witwatersrand in 1886. The Anglo-Boer War, as it was called then, but is known more properly today as the South African War or the White Man's War. Thousands of black Africans and indentured Indian labor were dragooned into the armies on either side. The Indians were not given arms, so they worked as menials and stretcher bearers. Gandhi and a bunch of passenger Indians felt they were not dragooned into the war. They volunteered, and they said it was their responsibility as imperial subjects. They volunteered their service and they joined this ambulance corps. Now, this war between the British and the Boer was one of the most brutal wars you can imagine in 1901. And the Boers were the guerrillas, the British had regular troops, and they were sweeping through the farms, setting them on fire. And for the first time, in fact, the concentration camps of Germany had their progenitors in the Boer War. The British opened these concentration camps, and the Boers, men, women and children, were held in these camps. Around 27 to 30,000 people died in these camps. But Gandhi, of course, the British won the war. And after the war, this is just priceless. After the war, the British announced that their troops would be given a slab each of the Queen's chocolate as a reward for their bravery. Gandhi wrote a letter to the colonial secretary to ask for the largesse to be extended to the ambulance corps leaders who had volunteered without pay. I'm quoting you. "It will be greatly appreciated by them and prized as a treasure if the terms under which the gift has been graciously made by Her Majesty would allow of its distribution among the Indian leaders." The colonial secretary replied curtly to say, "No chocolate for you." In 1901, with the Boer War behind him, Gandhi spoke of how the objectives of the Natal Indian Congress were to achieve a better understanding between the English and the Indians. He said he was looking forward to an imperial brotherhood towards which everyone who was friend of the empire should work. But this was not to be, because the Boers managed to outmaneuver and out-brotherhood Gandhi. And in 1902, they signed a treaty with the British. And according to the treaty, the Boer republics of the Transvaal and the Orange Free State became colonies of the British Empire. And in return, the British basically said, "We will allow you to self-rule to the Boers." So what happens is that Jan Smuts, who was once this dreaded Boer terrorist, switched sides and eventually led the British Army of South Africa in the First World War. The white folks made peace. They divided the diamonds, the gold, and the land between themselves. Black, Indian, and colored people were left out of the equation. No diamonds, no gold, no land, no chocolate. Gandhi was not deterred. After a few years of the South African War, he once again volunteered for active service. In 1906, the Zulu chief, Bambatha Kamantshinsa, sorry, I'm pronouncing it wrong, led his people in an uprising against the British government's newly imposed £1 tax, poll tax. The Zulus and the British were old enemies and had fought each other before. In 1879, the Zulus had routed the British army when it attacked the Zulu kingdom, a victory that put the Zulu on the world map. Eventually, over the years, because they could not match the firepower of the British troops, they were conquered and driven off their land. Still, they refused to work on the white man's farms, which is why bonded indentured labor was shipped in from India. Time and again, the Zulus had risen up, and during the Bambatha rebellion, the rebels, armed only with spears and cowhide shields, fought British troops equipped with modern artillery. As news of the rebellion came in, Gandhi published a series of letters in Indian Opinion, a Gujarati English newspaper that he had started in 1903. One of his chief benefactors was Sri Ratanji Jamsetji Tata of the Tata Industrial Empire. In a letter dated 18th November 1905, Gandhi basically writes saying, you know, during the Boer War you didn't give us weapons, so we had to be in the ambulance corps. But now we are asking you to give us weapons so we can engage in actual warfare. But of course they didn't give them weapons. On the 14th of April 1906, Gandhi wrote again and he said, "What is our duty during these calamitous times in the colony? It is not for us to say whether the revolt of the Kaffirs, the Zulus, is justified or not. We are in Natal by virtue of British power. Our very existence depends on it. It is therefore our duty to render whatever help we can." There was a discussion in the press as to what part the Indian community would play in the event of actual warfare. We have already declared in the English columns of this journal that the Indian community is prepared to play its part, and we believe what we did during the Boer War should also be done now. The rebellion was eventually contained. Chief Bambata was captured and beheaded. 4,000 Zulus were killed. Thousands more were flogged and imprisoned. Even Winston Churchill, Master of War and at that time Under Secretary of State, was disturbed by the violence. He said, quote, "It is my duty to warn the Secretary of State that this further disgusting butchery will excite in all probability great disapproval in the House of Commons. The score between black and white stands at present at about 3,500 to 8. Gandhi, on his part, never regretted the role he played in the White Man's War and in the Bambata Uprising. He just reimagined it. Years later, 1928, in Satyagraha in South Africa, the memoirs he wrote in Yerawada Central Jail, both stories had, shall we say, evolved. By then, the chessmen on the board had moved, Gandhi had turned against the British, and in his new account, the truth about the stretcher-bearer corps in the Bambata rebellion had grown into another truth. And now I'm quoting. The Zulu rebellion broke out just while attempts were being made to impose further disabilities upon Indians in the Transvaal. Therefore, I made an offer to the government to raise a stretcher-bearer corps for service with the troops. The corps was on active service for a month. We had to cleanse the wounds of several Zulus which had not been attended to for as many as 5 or 6 days and were therefore stinking horribly. We liked the work. The Zulus could not talk to us, but from their gestures and the expression in their eyes, they seemed to feel as if God had sent them to our succor. This retrospectively constructed image of the flogged, defeated Zulu, a dumb animal conveying his gratitude to God's missionaries of peace, is completely at odds, as we shall see, with his views about Zulus that were published in the pages of his newspaper during these years. In Gandhi's reimagining of the story of the Bambata rebellion, the broken Zulu became the inspiration for another of his causes. Arbitrarily, he started talking about celibacy. Like, while he was working with the Zulus, he decided that he must be celibate, and then the whole thing of Satyagraha starts. But in September 1906, only months after the Bambata rebellion, despite his offers of friendship and his demonstrations of loyalty, Gandhi was let down once again. The British government passed the Transvaal Asiatic Law Amendment Act. Its purpose was to control Indian merchants who were regarded as competition to white traders from entering the Transvaal. So basically, most of the Indians lived in this place called Natal, working on the sugar farms and so on. And the white population was getting very, very nervous about the growing Indian population because more and more labor were being brought in. So, and they didn't want the Indian businessmen, basically the Gujarati Baniyas and the Boras, to go into the Transvaal because they were ruthless businessmen, and the Europeans were worried about, you know, getting competition from them. So suddenly they said Indians can't go to the Transvaal without a pass, And suddenly a community whose leader had been dreaming of an imperial brotherhood had once again been reduced to, quote, a status lower than that of the aboriginal races of South Africa and the coloured people. This is Gandhi's description. Gandhi led the struggle of the business passenger Indians bravely and from the front. 2,000 people burned their passes in public. Gandhi was assaulted mercilessly, arrested and imprisoned. And then his worst nightmare became a reality. The man who could not bear to even share the entrance of a post office with the Kaffirs now had to share a prison cell with them. So here's Gandhi on his prison experience. We were all prepared for hardships, but not quite for this experience. We could understand not being classed with the whites, but to be placed on the same level with the natives seemed to be too much to put up with. I then felt that Indians had not launched our passive resistance too soon. Here was further proof that the obnoxious law was meant to emasculate Indians. Apart from whether or not this implies degradation, I must say it's rather dangerous. Kaffirs as a rule are uncivilized, the convicts even more so. They are troublesome, very dirty, and live almost like animals. So, you know, I mean, the Aam Aadmi Party today, which is a Gandhian party with a Gandhian cap, is doing some Gandhian, un-Gandhian activity like going after Mukesh Ambani. But its behavior in Shirki village was very, very Gandhian. A year later, the 16th of the 20 years he would spend in South Africa, Gandhi wrote, "My second experience in jail, in Indian opinion, on the 16th of January 1909. Quoting, "I was given a bed in a cell where there were mostly Kaffir prisoners who had been lying ill. I spent the night in the cell in great misery and fear. I read the Bhagavad Gita which I had carried with me. I read the verses which had a bearing on my situation." And meditating on them managed to compose myself. The reason why I felt so uneasy was the Kaffir and the Chinese prisoners appear to be wild, murderous and given to immoral ways. The Chinese appear to be worse. He came near the bed and looked closely at me. I kept still. Then he went to a Kaffir lying in bed. The two exchanged obscene jokes, uncovering each other's genitals. I have resolved in my mind on an agitation to ensure that Indian prisoners are not lodged with the Kaffirs or others. We cannot ignore the fact that there is no common ground between them and us. Moreover, those who wish to sleep in the same room as them have ulterior motives for doing so." My God. From inside the cell, Gandhi began to petition the white authorities for separate wards and prisons. He led battles demanding segregation on many counts. He wanted separate blankets because he worried that a blanket that has been used by the dirtiest of Kaffirs may later fall to an Indian's lot. He wanted prison meals especially suited to Indians, rice served with ghee. And he refused to eat the mealy pap that Kaffirs seemed to relish. This is all quotes, huh? He also agitated for separate lavatories for Indian prisoners. But 20 years later, in 1928, the truth about all this had transmogrified into another story. Responding to a proposal for segregated education for Indians and Africans, Gandhi said, "Indians have too much in common with the Africans to think of isolating themselves from them. They cannot exist in South Africa for any length of time without the active sympathy and friendship of the Africans. I am not aware of the general body of the Indians having ever adopted an air of superiority to their African brethren." Then in 1939, disagreeing with Jawaharlal Nehru, believed that black Africans and Indians should stand together against the white regime, Gandhi contradicted himself again. And he said, "However much one may sympathize with the Bantus, Indians cannot make common cause with them." Gandhi was a well-educated, well-traveled man. He would have been aware of the winds that were blowing in other parts of the world. His disgraceful words about Africans were written around the same time W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "The souls of black folks. One ever feels this two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." Gandhi's attempts to collaborate with the colonial regime were taking place at the time that the anarchist Emma Goldman was saying, "The centralization of power has brought into being an international feeling of solidarity among the oppressed nations of the world, a solidarity which represents a greater harmony of interest between the working man of America and his brothers abroad than between the American miner and his exploiting compatriot. A solidarity which fears not foreign invasion because it is bringing all the workers to the point when they will say to their masters, 'Go and do your own killing. We've done it long enough for you.'" There was Pandita Ramabai, who is actually even predates Gandhi, who traveled to America, who met black people, who wrote beautifully about them. There's Phule, Jyotiba Phule, who dedicated Gulamgiri, his work Gulamgiri, to, I'm quoting, "the good people of the United States as a token of admiration for their sublime disinterested and self-sacrificing devotion to the cause of Negro slavery." And he, Phule talks a lot about how the empathy between Indian Dalits and the Negro slaves. So you see, the empathy can achieve what scholarship can't sometimes. But despite all of Gandhi's suffering in unsegregated South African prisons, the past laws, you see, after all that Gandhi did there, whatever he did, segregation sort of eventually hardened into apartheid. But around that time, this very wealthy German architect called Hermann Kallenbach gave him 1,100 acres of land, farmland, to start Tolstoy Farm. So that is where he sat and began his experiments with satyagraha and truth in those circumstances. So I just want to talk to you a little bit about how this whole thing about satyagraha began, non-violent satyagraha. Given Gandhi's proposals to partner with the British in their colonialization of South Africa and British reluctance to accept that partnership, satyagraha, appealing to your opponent with the force of truth and love, was the perfect political tool. Gandhi was not trying to overwhelm or destroy a ruling structure. He simply wanted to be friends with it. The intensity of his distaste for the raw Kaffir was matched by his affection and admiration for the British. Satyagraha seemed to be a way of reassuring them, a way of saying, "Look, you can trust us. Look at us. We'd rather harm ourselves than harm you." This is not to suggest that satyagraha is not and cannot, in certain situations, be an effective means of political resistance. I am merely describing the circumstances in which Gandhi began his experiments in satyagraha. Essentially, his idea of satyagraha revolved around a regimen of renunciation and purification. Renunciation naturally segued into a missionary approach to politics. The emphasis on purity and purification obviously derived from the caste system, though Gandhi inverted the goalposts and later called his ministrations to untouchables a process of self-purification. On the whole, it was a brand of hair shirt Christianity combined with his own version of Hinduism and esoteric vegetarianism, which ended up underlining the impurity of Dalits, Muslims, and all the rest of us meat eaters, in other words, a majority of the Indian population. The other attraction was brahmacharya, celibacy. The practice of semen retention and complete sexual abstinence became the minimum qualification for a pure satyagrahi. Crucifixion of the flesh, denial of pleasure and desire, and eventually almost every normal human instinct became a major theme. Even eating came in for some serious stick. He says, taking food is as dirty an act as answering the call of nature. Would a person who was starving think of eating as a dirty act? Gandhi always said that he wanted to live like the poorest of the poor. The question is, can poverty be simulated? Poverty, after all, is not just a question of having no money or no possessions. Poverty is about having no power. As a politician, it was Gandhi's business to accumulate power, which he did effectively. Satyagraha wouldn't have worked even as much as it did if it wasn't for his star power. If you're powerful, you can live simply, but you cannot be poor. In South Africa, it took a lot of farmland and organic fruit trees to keep Gandhi in poverty. The battle of the poor and the powerless is a battle of reclamation, not renunciation. But Gandhi, like many successful godmen, was an astute politician. He understood that the act of renunciation by someone who has plenty to renounce has always appealed to the popular imagination. Gandhi would eventually discard his Western suit and put on a dhoti in order to dress like the poorest of the poor. Ambedkar, on the other hand, born unmoneyed, untouchable, and denied the right to wear clothes that privileged caste people wore, would show his defiance by wearing a three-piece suit. The irony is that while Gandhi was performing the rituals of poverty in Tolstoy Farm, he was not questioning the accumulation of capital or the unequal distribution of wealth. He was not holding out for improved working conditions for the indentured or for the return of land to those who it had been stolen from. He was fighting for the Indian merchants' right to expand their business to the Transvaal and to compete with British merchants. For centuries before Gandhi and for years after him, Hindu rishis and yogis have practiced feats of renunciation far more arduous than Gandhi's. However, they've done it alone on a snowy mountainside or in a cave set in a wind-blown cliff. Gandhi's genius was that he yoked his otherworldly search for moksha to a very worldly political cause and performed both like a fusion dance for a live audience in a living theater. Over the years, he expanded his experiments to include his wife and other people, some of them too young to know what they were being subjected to. Towards the end of his life, as an old man in his 70s, he took to sleeping with two young girls, Manu, his 17-year-old grandniece, and Abha. These girls were known as his walking sticks. He did this, he said, in order to gauge the degree of success or failure of his conquest over sexual desire. Leaving aside the very contentious, disturbing issues of consent and propriety, leaving aside the effect it had on the girls, the experiment raises another distressing and almost horrifying question. For Gandhi to extrapolate from the results of sleeping with two or three or four women that he had or had not conquered heterosexual desire suggests that he viewed women not as individuals, but as a category, that for him a very small sample of a few physical specimens, including his own grandniece, could stand in for the whole species. Now, there's a lot more about what happened in South Africa. I'll just end by saying that he left South Africa in 1913, which was the year. In 1913, he finally actually made some political solidarity with indentured labor and with coal miners. He joined the strikes. The strikes went out of control. He signed an agreement with Jan Smuts, and the agreement seems to have said that he had to leave South Africa, so he left. But in all his years in South Africa, Gandhi maintained that Indians deserve better treatment than the Africans. The jury is still out on whether Gandhi's political activity helped or harmed the Indian community in the long run. But his consistent attempts to collaborate with the British government certainly made the Indian community vulnerable during the rise of African nationalism. When Indian political activists joined the liberation movement under African leadership in the 1950s and saw their freedom as being linked to the freedom of African people, they were breaking with Gandhi's politics, not carrying on his legacy. when Indians joined the black consciousness movement in the 70s, seeking to build a broader black identity, they were actually upending Gandhi's politics. It is these people, many of them who did time on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela and other African comrades, who have saved the South African community, from Indian community, from being painted as a race of collaborators and from being isolated and expelled like Indians were in Uganda. That Gandhi is a hero in South Africa is as undeniable as it is baffling. The explanation could be that after he left South Africa, Gandhi was re-imported, this time as the shining star of the freedom struggle in India. The Indian community in South Africa, already cut adrift from its roots, was, after Gandhi left, further isolated and brutalized by the apartheid regime. Gandhi's cult status in India and his connection to South Africa would have provided South African Indians with a link to their history and their motherland. In order for Gandhi to be a South African hero, it became necessary to rescue him from the past and to rewrite it. Gandhi himself began that project, and some writers of history have completed it. Towards the end of Gandhi's stay in South Africa, the first few biographies had spread the news. And then, you know, people like Charlie Andrews and a lot of white Christian missionaries came to South Africa. And they started saying, Gandhi is the living Christ, he has worked among the lowliest of the low, all of this was going on. But did he fight racism and imperialism in South Africa? He left South Africa in 1913, he went to London. In London, he won the Kaiser A. Hind, which is the highest award from the British imperial government for public service to the empire. And then he came to India, and somewhere on the ocean, he became a Mahatma. You know, somewhere on the seas, the wind said, you're a Mahatma. And by the time he arrived, he was a Mahatma. He was then greeted in these glittering ceremonies by the Birlas, who became his great sponsors. Because by then, the Birlas and the Tatas had made a lot of money by the 20s in the war. They had reached a glass ceiling. They had had enough of the British. And Gandhi became their patron saint. They basically funded, bankrolled him the whole of his life. Anyway, at the end of this, so by the 20s, I'm saying, you know, he arrives, he goes to Champaran. Nobody knows, who is this man? Is he a representative of the king? All these newspaper articles, Shahid Amin has written beautifully about it, how, you know, they started publishing things about rumors, about incense, and, you know, all kind of magic things happening, and he became a great, great person. And the taproot of Gandhi's Mahatmahood found its way into a fecund rill where feudalism met the future, where miracles met modernity, and from there it drew sustenance and prospered. The skeptics were few and didn't count for much. Gandhi was by now addressing rallies, this is in the 20s, up to 200,000 people. The hysteria had spread abroad. In 1921, the Unitarian minister John Haynes Holmes of the Community Church in New York, in a sermon called Who is the Greatest Man in the World, introduced Gandhi to his congregation as the suffering Christ of the 20th century. Years later, Martin Luther King would do the same, and he said Christ furnished the spirit and the motivation while Gandhi furnished the method. And they presented Gandhi with a whole new constituency, a paradoxical gift for a man who so feared and despised Africans. Perhaps because the Western Christian world was apprehensive about the spreading influence of the Russian Revolution and was traumatized by the horror of the First World War, Europeans and Americans vied to honor the living avatar of Christ. It didn't seem to matter that, unlike Gandhi, who was from a well-to-do family, his father was a prime minister of the princely state of Porbandar, Jesus was a carpenter from the slums of Jerusalem who stood up against the Roman Empire instead of trying to make friends with it, and he wasn't sponsored by big business. the most influential of Gandhi's admirers was the French dramatist Romain Rolland, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 15. And he published a book in 1924 without meeting Gandhi called Mahatma Gandhi, the Man Who Became One with the Universal Being. It sold more than 100,000 copies. It opens with an invocation of Tagore from the Upanishads. He is the one luminous creator of all Mahatma, always in the hearts of people enshrined, revealed through love, intuition and thought. Whoever knows him, immortal becomes. Gandhi said he found real vision of truth in this book. And he called Rolland his self-chosen advertiser. By 1924, on the list of executives of his own organization, the All India Spinners Association, his name appeared as Mahatma Gandhi. Sad then for him to say in the first para of his response to annihilation of caste, quote, "Whatever label he wears in the future, Dr. Ambedkar is not the man to allow himself to be forgotten," as though pointing to the profound horrors of the caste system was just a form of self-promotion for Ambedkar. This is the man, or if you are so inclined, the saint that Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar, born in 1891 into an untouchable Mahar family, presumed to argue with. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am, for that insight. As you mentioned, on Gandhi's days in South Africa, that was an excellent lecture. We are all really grateful to you for having come to Jamia and given us your insight into an interpretation of Gandhi's days in South Africa and its implications for the Indian freedom movement as well. I would now like to throw the house open for questions. Those who would like to ask questions need to write their questions and give it to the dais so that we can take you turn by turn. Any questions? Please write your question and give it here.
This is my lord. Actually, let them just ask. It might take too long. No?
Some people can start. Yeah.
Okay. You may start. I don't think we'll be able to hear her from there.
From here? Yeah.
Yeah, please, ma'am.
Yeah.
Can I place it in a form of a comic if you don't mind?
Sure.
I accepted Gandhi was as English as an Englishman. He traveled long distance just to learn how to tie a bow tie. But thus being privileged and then realizing the discrimination around is different what from not being privileged and realizing it, right? Gandhi can be seen as an idea, as a philosophy, as a politician. As a politician, he prepared the stage of freedom. He prepared the masses to realize what freedom means before getting it. Had we realized the meaning of freedom in 20s or 30s, we have been prepared for it. Whatever Gandhi did and whatever he said is, according to me, much below importance what he actually did. He made us realize what we want and what we should demand. In this regard, all his statements, which can be easily criticized, hold no value against what he did. Why is your lecture only targeting what he said or remarked, not why what he made us capable of? He set a model. No other can match by leaving his clothes when he saw a lady half washing only single sari and half wearing it, right? And he announced celibacy and showed that his personal life is nothing to him when it comes to a struggle. Even it is said about Tagore that he was very intimate with his sister-in-law, and after when he got married, the lady suicide after a month and so, that is very personal life of a person. If we go in that personal life, we can criticize people like that, figures like that, right? Then why your lecture concentrate only Gandhi as a man? Why not Gandhi as an idea which not only revolutionized India, but also the world around? even I agree making Gandhi poor was very costly, but the moral of his struggle story gave ideas to ignite the fire of freedom. Don't you think Gandhi as an idea is so very powerful that discussing Gandhi as a man is useless?
Okay, I think I did begin by saying that this was just part of... Oh, should I go there? Yeah, I think I did begin by saying this was just a lead-in into what he said and did. You see, I would say that the most important question here is, let's say that Gandhi's most important contribution to the idea of political resistance is the idea of non-violence and satyagraha, let's say. So my point is, how do you rest the doctrine of non-violence and satyagraha on the foundations of a society that is based on caste, and that caste can only be kept in place by extreme violence? You know, it's not just a question of purity and pollution and you can't touch this and you can't come there, but how do you maintain the caste system? The caste system is a system of purity and pollution fused on the refusal to allow people entitlement, you know, entitlement to land, entitlement to knowledge, entitlement to education. Ambedkar writes so brilliantly on this, if you read Annihilation of Caste, as to how does a group of, after all, you know, how does a group of 2% of the population are Baniyas, say 10% or less are Brahmins, Kshatriyas, how do they disempower millions of people by putting in place a system of such egregious violence? Just like during the times of slavery, it is not just that black people who escaped would be killed, they would be killed in a ritualistic way to spread the terror. If you do this, this will happen to you. You know, so in the same way, even today, Dalits are not just killed, they are lynched, they are burnt, to show that, look, if you question this system exists not just on the perpetration of violence, but on the continuous threat of violence. So, of course, I'm sure it's happy for upper caste or privileged caste people. We feel that, oh, we got freedom. Many people, others feel it was just a transfer of power, you know. So you have to, I've written at length about the idea of Gandhi. What does that mean? What does that idea stand for? Are there differences? If you look at the things he did, forget the things he said. I mean, you look at, for example, what he did to force Ambedkar to sign the Pune Pact. You know, these are things that he did. For example, you know, like, we are living in a society. I mean, all of you have heard of the salt satyagraha, right? How many of you have heard about the Mahad Satyagraha? Very few. What was the Mahad Satyagraha? Gandhi didn't support it. The Mahad Satyagraha was when the British actually passed an ordinance saying that despite the social mores of our society, Dalits, untouchables, depressed classes will have access to public tanks, to public lakes, they will have to public wells, they can drink water. So Ambedkar led, after 4 years of mobilization, led the Mahad Satyagraha, where Dalits walked through the town of Mahad and drank water from the tank, from a public tank. The Brahmins purified it and put cow dung into it and did all sorts of pod shit into it to purify it, you know. Now, tell me, Gandhi said when untouchables protest in this way, it's not Satyagraha, it's Duragraha. You know, so what sort of a society and what sort of a freedom and what sort of an idea is this?
Well, let there be other questions, please. Let there be other questions.
I'm Anita. I'm listening from the Center for Peace and Conflict Research. I have a very short question. Do you regard Gandhi as a peaceful revolutionary? or do you think he's no revolutionary at all?
Well, I don't regard him as peaceful because, as I said, you know, there is the peace of the graveyard, huh? There's a peace of the caste system. And, it's very easy to be peaceful when you want to hold a very hierarchical and unfair system in place and then say you're peaceful, you know. So I don't regard him as peaceful. I actually think that in many ways I would regard him as a reactionary and not a revolutionary, you know. I think that when I read the things that he said about caste, I was horrified. I was horrified. I mean, in 1936, the year that Ambedkar wrote this brilliant speech called Annihilation of Caste, let me tell you that I'm not, my introduction, not a hagiography of Ambedkar. There are some very, very problematic things in Ambedkar's Annihilation of Caste. Very, very problematic views on Adivasis, very different views from my own and Gandhi's. I'll tell you one way that Gandhi was a revolutionary was he was prescient in his understanding of the ravages of modern civilization, Western civilization, you know. But then with that understanding, he says, you have to have a doctrine of trusteeship where the rich should be allowed to remain with their wealth and do good, like corporate social responsibility, you know. So he had some very deep insights and some prophetic insights almost, but then he would counter those or nullify those with these very reactionary views. But the year that Ambedkar wrote Annihilation of Caste, 1936, Gandhi wrote one of the most extraordinary essays I've ever read. It was called The Ideal Bhangi, and it was a description of what qualities an ideal bhangi should have and how they should know everything about shit and they should examine people's shit and warn them in advance if they saw problems, you know, and how that bhangi should always be a bhangi and because it is a divine duty given to that bhangi, they should never even want to amass wealth out of it. Modi said exactly the same thing 7 years later, you know, about Balmikis. So, no, I mean, I'm not going to say Gandhi was a revolutionary on the whole, though there were some profound observations that he did have.
There is one.
Yeah. Your lecture reminded me of Judith Bront when she wrote late 60s, Gandhi's Rise to Power. Two, three things which are important to underline. Number one, Gandhi fell to the bullet of an assassin on 30th January 1948. But before that, series of attacks, violent attacks, including bomb attacks, were mounted on Gandhi for the fact that he was into politics of upsetting the existing caste order. Number one. Number two, in Delhi, every time he visited, he lived in two different places. And that was his life project, to reconcile the kind of contradictions that existed in the society. One area where he lived is known as Balmiki Colony, and I'm sure you must have visited that. Those Balmikis living in that colony, they still have kept the room in exactly the same shape that Gandhi used to use. You go through newspaper reports in late 30s, but particularly 40s, a lot of Congress leaders used to have problem visiting Gandhi in quote unquote Bhangi Colony, and those days newspapers had absolutely no qualms in mentioning this as a Bhangi Colony. And Gandhi lived with them, he dined with them, he drank with them and used their utensils and all that. On the other hand, there were occasions when he lived in the Birla house, and here is an attempt on the part of Gandhi to reconcile the two. Gandhi was, of course, as you said, bankrolled by Birlas and Tatas, certainly not Tatas but Birlas. But he is someone who exhorted Indians not to wear mill-produced clothes, not to use machine-produced articles, because they benefit only the rich capitalists, it would only fatten them. He asked them to wear hand-spun clothes and rest of it. So anyway, despite being sponsored by Birla for all his personal trips, etc., he wasn't the one who was really promoting crass capitalism or crony capitalism that we have today. So maybe, unfortunately, somehow your lecture reminds me of Judith Brown, not of the Gandhi the prisoner of, but the Gandhi rise to power.
I think if you read my introduction, as I said, and I took care to say, this is just one aspect of what I've written about. In fact, I've written in some detail about his visits to the Bangui colonies.
He used to live there.
I know that, you know, and I've been there, and I've also spoken to people. But my point is that if you look at what he was saying about caste, he was being a missionary, you know, and he was saying, I mean, there's another essay, I long to be a Bangui. Now, the point is, would you agree today to say that all Bangis should remain Bangis and the children should be children and the children's children should be Bangis? There's also a very, very long debate about how do you approach caste. For example, Gandhi and a lot of the Hindu reformers, the privileged caste Hindu reformers, they reduced the whole of caste to the issue of Bangis. You know, Bangis are not even, if you look at the caste system, there is no place for a Bangi in rural India. They don't need Bangis because people were using the fields. So the Bangis is an urban constituency. It was created, and then you can talk about purity and pollution and use this Bangi issue. Okay? So you, I mean, I request you to read the whole of it. I don't have any problem being called names or anything, but I have, in fact, written at length. I mean, one of the scholars who done a lot of work on Gandhi in the Bangui colonies about what did he eat, how did he eat, what went on there. You have to look at a person who has written 98 volumes, has never condemned caste. Yes.
As Gandhi vehemently denied the in Pune pact with Ambedkar to sign as separate electorate for Dalit, but he did not deny for the separate electorate for Muslim in 1909 and 1990 Act.
Yeah.
Please.
The question is that Gandhi eventually, when the communal award was given after the second roundtable conference, giving separate electorates for Muslims as well as for untouchables and Sikhs, and Gandhi agreed to everything else but not for the untouchables. He said that this, it's quite a long answer, you know, again I've addressed it at some length in the entire thing that I've written. But basically what happened is that when this whole politics of representation began to replace the politics of the empire, you know, until then millions were converting to Islam, nobody minded. Millions were converting to Sikhism, to Christianity, to escape the scourge of untouchability. Of course they never escaped. I mean, the Muslims and the Sikhs and the Christians in this country continue to practice caste. That's a separate matter. But when suddenly this anxiety over demography happened, there were 45 million untouchables, and the idea of them becoming a separate electorate and depleting the Hindu numbers became a huge issue, which is why even what we think of as the conservative and right-wing Hindus were actually proselytizing in very much more aggressive ways among untouchables to keep them in what they call the Hindu fold. And for example, Savarkar, V.D. Savarkar was part of the Mahat Satyagraha, you know. Tilak and Gandhi and all these people were saying the same thing about caste. And trying to keep them in the big house, but in the basement, you know. How do you do that? So Gandhi went on a fast because he said this will just break. So it was an unusual situation in which Dalits are not allowed to go into the temple, not allowed to drink water, not allowed to pass, not allowed to throw their shadow on caste Hindus. The separations are in every single way, but when they ask for a separate electorate, it's like the world has come to an end. Whereas when you see what Ambedkar actually submitted at the roundtable conference, he was not saying we want a separate election in order to separate. He was saying we want a separate electorate in order for 10 years, only for 10 years, in order that the Dalit people can develop a political consciousness, choose their own representatives, and eventually join
the mainstream in this non-apartheid fashion. He was talking about equality, about brotherhood. He was not talking about it in order to separate, you know. So, but this was something that Gandhi consistently refused to do, refused to allow them to have their own representation. He was like, I will represent you. I and my body represent the untouchables. When he started Harijan Sevak Sangh after the Pune Pact, no Harijans, as he called them, were allowed to be in the membership. You know, it was always, let me be your missionary. You know, let me display my goodness by doing things, you know. So, these were the things.
I have great appreciation of your lecture in the sense that you subjected Gandhi to serious intellectual inquiry. In most cases, we some other kind of look at him as a very relevant figure and don't ask uncomfortable questions because we didn't have a conclusion about it. And I would certainly love to hear if you have quoted Ambedkar's most important sentence, I think, that Ambedkar made during his conversation with Gandhi when he first met. Gandhi tried to brainwash him to fight for his freedom, and he said, Gandhi, for motherland. He said, Gandhi, I have no motherland.
Yeah.
You know, that's the same sentence that we are on the course in the chapters. I have two questions as part of the curiosity, and one a bit provocative to you. One is that we should also subject Ambedkar to the same sort of intellectual scrutiny. My question would be, was Ambedkar a feminist? What was his attitude towards the women of his own kind, of his own caste? And what kind of evidence we come out of it? I clearly disagreed and agreed with you on that particular interpretation of Gandhi and the debate on Ram Guha's interpretation when I said that you can't understand Gandhi unless you really reflect on Gandhi and the debate. Because Gandhi, there is an upper caste element, it was always there in the picture. My second question is that if you have to do a fourth experiment of Indian history, what would be the story of decolonization without Gandhi? Isn't that with all the flaws that we see and all the criticism that we have, I'm sure the story of decolonization is somewhere where Gandhi has some contribution that we need to appreciate. My last is a provocative one. When you plunged into Munarmada debate, Munarmada book, you know, by then you were a famous person as a Booker Prize winner, though most of us knew you as an activist in the university campus. You were asked a question that why did you take so long to join the movement? I vaguely remember the answer that you said, is there a particular starting point of making public thoughts or something like that? If we ask the same question to Gandhi and Gandhi gives the same answer with respect to his political awakening in South Africa, do you endorse Gandhi's answer or do you say something different?
Okay, good question. Yeah, okay. So, what was the first one? Oh yeah, Ambedkar's attitude to women. Well, look, I don't know if you've read Sharmila Rege's book called The Madness of Manu. And again, you should, because, you know, Ambedkar actually believed that one of the ways in which the caste system was perpetuated was through the control of women. And so, if you read the debates around the Hindu code bill, Ambedkar was the first one to say that women should have the right to property, to divorce and all this, and there was huge debates. People basically laid siege to parliament and Hindu sadhus, and I mean, he resigned in disgust, and it's extraordinary that he understood those things. How he was in his personal life with his wife, I don't know. I mean, I haven't written that about Gandhi either. Because I think those are subjects which, you know, we will never know in some way. So to answer your question, I think he paid a great deal of attention to the rights of women, and they could do. Your second question was about?
What would be the story of decolonization without Gandhi?
Look, I don't think we can ever deny that Gandhi played a very stellar role in the freedom struggle. But I think, again, I've written this, you know, that Ambedkar and Gandhi deepened our understanding of the meaning of imperialism and the meaning of freedom, you know. So it's true that when Gandhi first met Ambedkar in 1930 and he thought he was a Brahmin because he knew so much and he was so confident, and he just thought he was a sort of embittered, you know, self-hating Brahmin. And he said, he questioned him about his criticism of the Congress, which amounted in those days to criticism of the struggle for the homeland, and he said, "I have no homeland, no untouchable, what his name would be proud of this land." Now, a large section of the introduction that I have written has to do with caste in contemporary India. You know, and I really think that it is such a great shame that we spend, I just think it's a cover-up operation, let me just say it openly. I think what we have and the society we live in is a disgrace, and even the left, the intellectuals of the left have played a part in this project of unseeing, as I call it, you know. So I'll tell you a small fact. For example, in 1919, which was the height of what is known as the Red Summer in the US, when 165 black people were lynched, you know, in the Red Summer. In 2012, 651 Dalits are killed in India. The year of the Delhi gang rape and murder. 1,500 Dalit women are raped by upper castes. And this is just the reported rapes. We know that that's, the thumb rule is 10%, you know. 60 to 90% of Dalit people don't have land. Now look at even our most militant struggles, whether it's whichever, you know, all the struggles today, whether it's the Maoists, or whether it's the Narmada movement, or whether it's all the anti-displacement movements, which I'm associated with, and they are all very militant and wonderful struggles with brilliant arguments. But look at that, you know, in the 1960s, when Naxalwadi happened, when even JP's movement started, we were still talking about land to the tiller. We were still talking about the end of Zamindari. Today, you're talking only about leaving people who have land on the land. Adivasis at least have some land. What do? The landless, who are mostly Dalit, are out of the equation of even militant radical politics, you know. And I mean, this is just, I'm talking about the Dalits. We know now because of this whole neoliberal regime, 100 of India's richest people own 25% of the GDP. Look at the biggest business houses. Almost all are owned by Banyas, you know. Nobody talks about the upper caste, no? What is happening in court? What is happening in JNU? What is happening with reservation? It's a shocking picture that emerges. So is this freedom, and what kind of contribution did Mahatma Gandhi have to this, you know? I think these are very important things. Your last question was about me and the fact that when people ask me why did I join, firstly, I never joined the Narmada movement. I wrote The Greater Common Good, you know. And the question to me was, you know, since you got there so late, what about giving that same leeway to Gandhi? The fact is that Gandhi never changed. But I never changed either, let me say, that I mean, The God of Small Things is a novel that is about communism, it's about caste, it's about, I did not have to read Ambedkar to understand caste. I just had to grow up in an Indian village, and The God of Small Things is about that. And today, it even shocks me that there's not a sentence in that book that I disagree with after all the reading and research and that I've done to write this, you know. So everything doesn't have to come from research, you know, you come from life. And what I wrote about Phula Levi, all these things, I mean, if you look at the ways in which I studied architecture and what interested me about it, how do cities work? What do they do to the people who live in it? How is it that most of the laws are made for a few citizens and the rest are non-citizens for whom even the sewage system doesn't apply, for the shit on top of it, you know? So I think it's a politics. It's not about where you come from, here to there. You know, the point is, it is a very important thing to address two things. Are you being selective about what you say about Gandhi? And did he change? these are things that have to be addressed, but I'm afraid he didn't change very much, you know. And the point is, when a person says the kind of things that I read out, or writes an essay like the Ideal Bangi, even if he said beautiful things, these things you have to account for. Last question.
Yes.
It's about Mahatma Gandhi. Actually, he empowered a lot of women during his struggle for freedom. He is very much a practical man, rather than a utopian. First thing is that. The second thing is, after independence, we are most inspired by Mr. Gandhi and his ideas. And in this very much assembly, we are sitting without any caste or class. It's true how much we inspired from Mr. Gandhi, and his idea is so much practical to be implemented. Nehru is also a Gandhian who is very much a socialist, which provide a strong base for the development of India, but we are enjoying it here.
Okay. That's your question. Well, I don't think that even if you look at this audience, you should say that we are sitting here without caste. Okay? I mean, and let me tell you that there's a lot of statistics on that and a lot of reflection on that in my book. As for empowering women, I'm sorry, but I feel totally disempowered by Gandhi, because I'm not that perfect, beautiful, khadi-wearing, moral housewife that he wanted in the struggles, right? I mean, the kind of things he did with women is an outrage, you know? And he empowered a certain kind of woman who would fit into a certain kind of society, and I refuse to fit into that society, and I'm sure many women here will agree with me. Nehru was, I think, more slightly less of a enemy to Ambedkar, yet, you know, towards the end of Ambedkar's rise, you see, one of the critiques that I have in the book about Ambedkar is this kind of embrace of Western modernity and liberalism, which I don't agree with, and he himself eventually renounced it and became a Buddhist. He wrote a great book on the Buddha and his Dhamma. He wore suits, but he died in debt. He didn't die in the Birla house, you know. And he didn't have money to publish that book. And he asked Nehru, you know, can you buy a few advance copies? But no, you know, so that book was published after he died. But, you know, I don't want to widen this debate into Nehru and Sardar Patel and the whole thing now, because as we know, these are very controversial things. I don't want to speak loosely. But all these things are addressed in the book, in the introduction as well as in Annihilation of Caste.
Why did I?
Why do I support it? I don't think I said anything about her work. I just was shocked that here was an occasion, a big publisher with plenty of resources, an outfit which has been in the business of trying to get books banned and removed from curriculums and so on, like this Shiksha Bachao Andolan. And there was no court order, there was no ban, there was no threat. And this publisher just succumbed, a publisher that has in the past stood up for free speech. You see, the point is that there are many, many, many books or things that are said that some of us find horrible, you know, but should they exist in the world? Gandhi, in that way, did support Ambedkar's right to be heard and argued with, you know. to me, I think we must really see that every time someone points a sword at a person and says that you will not speak, that sword might go into that person, but it also goes into you. And you create a society where people are not allowed to air their views, they are not allowed to discuss, and those frustrations build up and they end with that society imploding. So every time the Taliban cuts off someone's head for saying something, it also cuts off its own head without knowing it, you know?
It is my privilege to offer the vote of thanks on behalf of the Nelson Mandela Center. Our first vote of thanks are due to our keynote speaker for the day, Ms. Roy, and for giving her time and enlightening us with her thoughts. So thank you very much, ma'am. To the Vice Chancellor in absentia for his encouragement and support and cooperation. Of course, to the audience, because without you all, it could not have been all possible. So thank you very much to the faculty members, to the foreign dignitaries for coming up and to the students to come and listen to the questions.